I mean, when you think about, like, the biggest panic there ever was about the death of rock, I would say that was disco, correct?
Right.
Well, disco kind of became a mainstream thing in 1975. And then Disco Demolition Night in Chicago was in 1979. So that's a four-year period during which mammoth rock records were still released. Fleetwood Mac Rumors and, like, the first Van Halen record, a whole bunch of albums, right? Well, it's 2016 now. How far do we have to go back for a real meaningful rock record? I mean, it's getting to be this thing where it doesn't really seem like a theoretical supposition anymore.
93X presents the Celebration Rock Podcast with Steve and Hayden.
This is the Celebration Rock Podcast presented by 93X FM here in Minneapolis. I'm your host, Stephen Hayden. My guest today is Chuck Klosterman, the author of But What If We're Wrong, as well as a lot of other books that you have probably read if you were listening to this podcast. Chuck has been on the most of any guest on this podcast so far. This will be his third appearance. So wherever you are, Amanda Petrusich, you need to catch up to Chuck, because it was tied between Chuck and Amanda. And I think Ian Cohen is in there too, actually. So Chuck just vaulted ahead. So hopefully we'll get Amanda and Ian on soon to tie him up. But, you know, it's always great to have Chuck on. And, you know, when I invite Chuck on the podcast, it is a bit of a selfish thing because he doesn't really talk about music that much anymore. You know, he's moved on to talking about a lot of different topics, but, you know, his sort of original role as a rock critic, you know, he's left that behind to some degree. So to me, if I can get Chuck Klosterman talking about rock music, it's sort of like getting Eddie Murphy to do stand-up again. So it's always fun for me to have him on. And I had a good excuse this time because, of course, he has this book that came out in June called But What If We're Wrong, and it's a really great book. I recommend checking it out if you haven't already. And there's a chapter in there where he talks about, well, first of all, I should say what the book is about overall. Chuck has this theory in the book that he talks about how the way that we think about the world right now, you know, all the assumptions that we make about the way things are the way they are, that when we look back, or when someone looks back, in 200, 300 years, it's very likely that the assumptions that we have at this moment in 2016 are going to be proven wrong. And we can be reasonably assured of that because when we look at the past and we look at what previous cultures thought, previous iterations of American culture, what they believed about the world, we can see that a lot of their assumptions were wrong. So what Chuck tries to do in his book is to figure out what are the things that we believe now? You know, what are the things that we believe now? What's going to be disproven in the future? And one of the things that he talks about is rock music. And he writes about how when genres end up fading away from sort of the center of culture, there always ends up being one person who becomes the figurehead of that genre. So like when we talk about marching band music, for instance, John Philip Sousa is the person that we always remember. Right now with reggae music, it seems like Bob Marley is the figurehead. And that's the one reggae artist that everyone knows, and everyone else in that genre has sort of faded away. So in one of the chapters of Chuck's latest book, he tries to figure out which rock artist is that going to be. So I wanted to talk to him about that chapter, as well as some other sort of historical issues result as they pertain to rock music, and how is this genre going to be remembered. And it ended up being a really interesting conversation. I think you'll really enjoy it, and here it is. Well, Chuck, thanks for coming on the podcast again. You are, and I say this every time you come on, but you are the you have the most appearances on this podcast. You are extending your record.
I'm like the Chuck Yeager of this. I keep breaking the barrier. Some people go twice. I saw Amanda was on twice, so now I go three.
Yep, exactly. So yeah, it's like a one-upsmanship between you and Amanda right now. So your book came out back in June. And are you still on the book tour?
No. I did that for 3 weeks. I did the East Coast 1 week, Midwest 1 week, and the West Coast 1 week. And now it's done. Yeah.
And what was that experience like, you know, actually going out and seeing readers and talk to them about the book? I mean, what did you find that people said about the book? Were you surprised at all by things that they took from it that maybe didn't intend?
Well, no. I mean, on the one hand, you know, this is like ninth book, I think, by the seventh time I've toured. So it's not exactly like a new experience. Now, I mean, when you're single, it's really fun. And then when you're in a relationship, it's less fun. And then when you have kids, it's kind of no fun. So touring is just something that I do, although it is always fun to do the events. I guess, to be honest, I was happy that the response was as large as it was. I mean, honestly, I guess I had assumed that part of my career had kind of peaked, and that now there was probably X number of people who were still interested in my books, and I just had to sort of keep convincing those people to buy the books going forward in order to sort of have a career. And it was surprising that this book did better, and that suddenly the audiences were very big again, and there were people buying the book who hadn't bought the other ones. So that was the main thing I took away from it. In terms of their response, not really. I mean, I think that what tends to happen when you write about a lot of different subjects like I do in this book, that people have issues with the subject that they feel they have the most expertise in. So if they feel like they really understand science, they sort of accept all the other arguments but have an issue with some of the science points. Or if they really feel like they understand football, they will accept all the science points, but they'll have issues with that. And with rock music, same thing. It's like whenever people sort of have a dispute with like this, it tends to be because they feel a degree of ownership over a specific part that they feel that they are fluent in.
I mean, do you enjoy that process of hearing from readers and, you know, finding out, like, what they took from the book, or does that ever get...
In person, definitely,
yeah.
Because in person people are very polite, and that the fact that they came out to an event means that they're pretty engaged with it. You know, it's like that they care enough to get in a car and drive to a bookstore and show up. So of course, yeah, like, anybody who wants to talk to me about something in my book in person, I tend to enjoy, because I think it makes me feel good.
Yeah. Yeah, but like from how you're phrasing that, I'm guessing that the online experience isn't always a joy.
Well, that's a different thing, because that's like somebody who just, you know, not necessarily if they have bad motives or something, but it's not the same. I mean, it's not the same as somebody saying like I am actually talking to you for real. This is not something I'm doing sort of to, like, I know what the person's intention is. But really, and you maybe have experienced this too. I mean, the response you get to a book is so much different than the response you get to an article. Because the article is sort of being consumed by someone, usually for free. They're really not spending a lot of time with it, even if it's a long piece. It's not the same. It's like they're almost more interested in responding than they are in actually reading it. But that's not how it is with books. I mean, somebody reads a book, and if they want to respond, it means they like the book, you know?
Yeah, yeah, I mean... my experience with that has been, I would liken it to being like a headline act, where when you write a book, you know that people, like, they bought a ticket to get into the room. So there's like a, you know, a 75% chance that they're going to like what you're talking about, because they're sort of already amenable to who you are. Whereas if you write something like an article online, it's like playing a music festival. You know, it's like anyone can walk in and they might like you or they might not like you. You know, the guarantee that people will be responsive to what you're doing is a lot lower in that kind of situation.
Well, like I said, the magnitude is so different.
Yeah.
I mean, if 50,000 people buy your book, you did great. If 50,000 people read a piece on Grantland, it means like nobody read it.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like you're dealing with a smaller group of people, and who kind of self-select themselves. They're the kind of people, they still buy books, for one thing,
yeah.
You know, and that's a kind of a continually dwindling part of the populace. Even though the book sales, on the whole, are kind of creeping upward, it tends to be the same 200 or 300 books that are being purchased over and over again. So it's kind of very interesting when to meet the people who are still like, well, this is still part of who I am. You know, I still like to buy these books. Yeah.
I heard the interview that you did with Marc Maron, and he described the book as a midlife crisis book, which is not what I took from it. But I'm wondering, is that something other people have mentioned to you that, you know, that they read into it?
No, just him. That was an interesting thing for him to say, and I understand why. I think that he probably reads a lot of nonfiction writing in that way, because I think that that's something that he's always sort of thinking about. It is sort of his own degree of crisis. I didn't feel that way at all. In fact, I told him this in the interview. I kind of felt that way about Killing Yourself to Live a little bit, even though I was only 33, which would suggest I wasn't going to live very long. But I mean, I feel like the things in that book were very personal and very much sort of like working through kind of these existential problems about who I was and what I did. I don't feel like that was part of this book at all.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
I mean, do you feel like when you write a book that you can predict what people will like about it and what they won't like? I mean, because I feel like when I wrote my book, I felt like, okay, the people who aren't going to like it are not going to like it for these reasons. And that proved to be right for the most part. Whereas, I felt like this is going to appeal to a certain kind of person, and this is what they're going to take from it, and that kind of person's going to like it, and other people won't. Do you feel like you have that, or are you surprised sometimes by the responses that people have? Like, maybe they like something that you didn't expect, or the opposite?
Well, I do think it's not that difficult to predict what people won't like about something, because those things tend to be much more predictable and consistent.
Yeah.
I mean, if anybody writes a book that uses the first person at all, there's going to be some people who are going to say it's self-indulgent. It's going to happen every single time. It doesn't matter how you do it, even if it's only, a tenth of the book or whatever. If your book involves a lot of research, there's going to be people who have quibbles with the research. If the book is sort of more just sort of your experience or your sense, people are going to complain that there isn't research, you know. So the things that people don't like about books is pretty rote. The things that they do like is always surprising. I am continually surprised by that, because the things people like tend to be extremely specific.
Right.
And in the same way that it's very easy to write a negative review of a record, but hard to write about a review of a record you love, it's sort of hard to distill the positive emotion into sort of a cogent language. But it's very easy to do that with things you don't like, because, you know, all you have to do is just take one small bit and take it too seriously or take it out of context, and of course it'll seem idiotic.
Yeah. Right. Well, you know, since this is a rock music podcast, when we talk about your book here, I want to just focus on the rock music chapter in your book. And you write about, sort of the theory behind this chapter is you're looking at how with genres that have, you know, sort of a period of time where they're really popular and then they fade away, that there tends to be one artist that is remembered as the figurehead of that genre. And you use the example of John Philip Sousa for marching band music. I think you also talk a little bit about Bob Marley, how that seems to be in the process of happening with reggae, about how Bob Marley seems to be the artist that gets remembered, whereas all the other artists have sort of faded away.
Yeah, I mean, you can see that Bob Marley is, and this probably happened within our lifetime, is becoming bigger than reggae. The likelihood of going into a college dorm room and finding a Bob Marley poster is much higher than going on that person's iTunes and finding multiple reggae songs from any artist.
Right. I'm wondering, you know, before we get into the particulars of that chapter, why was this something you wanted to write about in sort of the context of your book? Like, why did you feel like this was a good example of sort of the overall thesis of the book?
The subtitle of the book is like thinking about the present as if it were the past. And I think that this is a good example of how that works. You know, thinking about the world we have now as it'll appear to people in some distant future. All of my books involve some rock music. I mean, that's the only thing that's in every one of my books. To some degree, there is some, you know, so I knew I was going to write about rock music. And, You know, there's this, you know, this concept, and I think you've talked about this on this podcast, and I think disagreed with it, actually, this idea that, you know, rock is dead or whatever. I always think people misinterpret that phrase, that they seem to think that when someone is saying rock is dead, what they're saying is that it's actually going to become extinct and it won't exist in any context. That's not what I mean when I say that. I mean it's moving out of the center of the culture, and that it's, there'll always be people making interest in the same way, that there's still people, you know, like, you know, making piano jazz now. It's just that whoever is the most famous jazz pianist right now, or whoever the 10 most famous jazz pianists are right now, are extremely talented, I am certain, but they're no longer these sort of iconic, totemistic figures in the culture, you know? And with rock music, people have often had this fear, but I gotta say, it's just different this time. I mean, when you think about, like, the biggest panic there ever was about the death of rock, I would say that was disco, correct? That was during the period people talked about the idea of rock dying during disco, and that was a big fear.
Right.
Well, disco kind of became a mainstream thing in 1975. And then Disco Demolition Night in Chicago was in 1979. So that's a four-year period during which mammoth rock records were still released. Fleetwood Mac Rumors and, like, the first Van Halen record, a whole bunch of albums, right? Well, it's 2016 now. How far do we have to go back for a real meaningful rock record?
Right.
I would say probably In Rainbows, and it wasn't for the music, but for the release. I mean, it's getting to be this thing where it doesn't really seem like a theoretical supposition anymore. I mean, it's we're getting very close to the period where somebody who would be really, who's been really into popular music for 10 or 15 years might have no memory of any rock record ever being a big deal. So it does seem like it is receding from the culture in a real way. It'll always be there. You'll always be able to find some rock songs on one radio station in your town. You know, it's like there's still good rock records coming out. I think that, you know, the Kerosene Headrest record to me is as good an album, probably rock record as I've heard since Separation Sunday. I think this whole year has been a particularly good year for rock records. The new Dinosaur Jr. record is awesome. But a Dinosaur Jr. record being good now is very different than a Dinosaur Jr. record being good in 1995.
And
what that would. So if this is happening, if rock is receding, and this is really, you know, and I'm right about this, at some point it is going to be an academic pursuit, that people are going to remember that it was extremely important to the society of the late 20th century, along with television, probably the biggest factor in shaping what culture was. So they're going to talk about it as a historical idea. And what will they talk about? So that was the question I kind of wrote about.
Right. And just to kind of go back to some of the points you were making there, I think what you're saying is indisputable. I mean, no one's going to make the argument, I think, that, like, rock music is, like, the dominant cultural, you know, music of today. It's certainly not the youth music of today. I think sometimes, like, where I argue against that is when critics want to sort of conflate sort of lack of cultural capital with artistic quality.
I mean, that's what music writing is now.
Right.
Now music writing is people writing about politics. I mean, and that used to be extremely interesting when, like, Greil Marcus was the only guy doing it. But also, Greil Marcus was really fucking smart. Now it's sort of the main way people talk about music. It's sort of like, how can I sort of place this artist within my political identity or in sort of my vision of how the world should be? So that's kind of all it is. So popularity now is the most important thing about a musician,
right,
in a way that's never been the case before.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there was an idea for a while that, like, that music writing was too insular, that it was only focused on sort of critic darlings, and it wasn't talking about sort of the mass, you know, sort of popular music. And now it's been inverted, where now if you aren't really popular, then, like, the idea of a band being important without selling a lot of records, which is something that was sort of like a foundation of music criticism for a long time, that sort of Velvet Underground idea that, like, only 1,000 people heard them, but they influence a lot of people, like, that seems to be gone now.
I would say it's just as insular, though, but in a different way.
Yeah.
Yes, they're talking about mega famous people. They're talking about Beyonce and Kanye West and Taylor Swift, But the way writers are talking about these people is still completely insulated from the way that music is being consumed by 99% of the populace.
Right.
That the people who are consuming these Taylor Swift records are not looking for politics inside of these albums.
Right.
And yet that's sort of the way. So instead of finding a band that's obscure as it used to be and sort of being like, I'm going to write about this interesting thing that's almost kind of interesting in its own separate silo, I'm not going to take this hugely popular thing and sort of shave off part of it and sort of make that into a different idea. And here again, it's like, I don't want to act like this is a terrible thing. I think in some ways it's an interesting way to write, but it's different than the way it was.
Yeah, I mean, is there something to be said about sort of the importance of like music overall? Like, you know, certainly rock music has been diminished, but I mean, is it fair to say that like music in general seems like less important at this point? Not to say that it won't come back, but like, and this again, I'm always sensitive about my age in this instance, because I am, you know, I'm almost 40, so maybe my perspective on this is a little skewed, but my feeling is that that now compared to like previous, you know, eras, that like it seems like there's like a couple of huge pop stars, and then there's like a lot of people that aren't really famous. You know, it's like you have Adele, you have Taylor Swift, you have Beyonce, you have Drake, you have Kanye West, you have Justin Bieber, and that's about it. And it is, I would make an analogy to movies in that, like, it seems like Hollywood right now, it's all in on blockbusters, whereas, and there's not really much left for anyone else. So it's just like, we're just kind of pushing all of our chips on like a select few people, because this system, you know, I mean, certainly economically, it's become, you know, less tenable. I feel like the way the culture has been moving in terms of media, you know, it's much more diffuse now. I mean, does any of this resonate with you? I mean, do you feel like popular music in general is sort of in the process of kind of splintering, and that idea of like a mass popular artist, you know, is maybe not going to be as common moving forward?
Well, yeah, although there are other factors at play at this that are like almost completely ancillary to the content itself. For example, you used movies as an example. Well, I mean, movies, culturally, you could argue, were more important in the 1940s when there really was no television, there wasn't any real sort of youth culture. Kids would go to the Bijou on Saturday, and that would be the entertainment for the week. That would be really the only thing, the only mass culture that they would sort of have any sort of relationship to. So I suppose the films of that period were more meaningful to the world at large than films now. But it doesn't seem like film is worse than it was in the 40s. Compared to the 40s, it certainly seems better. Music is less important than it used to be. I think the main reason, though, is that there are certain technological pursuits now, specifically video games, that aggressively appeal to the kind of people who would be the center of rock culture in the 70s, like young teenage boys, basically. That's part of it. And the post-Napster world sort of changed the value of money, of music, and its relationship to money. And now most people sort of assume that music should be almost free, and they're never going to go back. Like, that's like it did devalue the perceived worth of music. And it's a weird thing because, like, okay, so in 1995, using Fleetwood Mac rumors again, somebody would be like, well, I like this, it's worth $14 or whatever. Well, now no one thinks that way. They're like, well, I like this, how can I get it for nothing? And even though the music is unchanged, the way it, what it means, because we live in a capitalistic society, so the value of things and what they cost does impact how people see the thing itself.
I mean, getting back to the idea of like mass popular artists, though, I mean, it's interesting because I feel like 5 years ago, I would have predicted that like the idea of like a massive superstar on the level of like a Michael Jackson or a Prince, like what we had in the 80s, like wouldn't ever happen again, because of social media and sort of the fragmentation of culture just seemed like, well, things are just going to be, you know, diffuse and we're all going to be in our own niches and that's the way it's going to be. But now it seems like I totally feel the opposite. Like when you look at pop music, I feel like it's so dominated by like a small number of people, like the people, and they're the people that sell the most records. They're the people that generate the most media coverage. And if they aren't doing anything, then the needle doesn't get moved. That, you know, like Charlie XCX or something, you know, is someone that, you know, I like her records and she gets really good press, but she's not really like a superstar person. You know, she could stop making records tomorrow and it wouldn't really matter on a mass level. I mean, do you feel like just that nature of like pop stardom, you know, setting aside even rock stardom, I mean, do you feel like that's something that's going to continue moving forward? I mean, or are we...
Well, I do. I mean, I do. Well, time, like, this is... We're still kind of in, like, the early stages of this, so time will tell. But, I mean, I have the growing suspicion that the Internet, in many ways, is sort of doing the opposite of what we predicted.
Right.
That the idea would be that this Internet would sort of democratize opinion. And that there would be more voices and therefore more ideas and more personalities and more celebrities, that it would be just a, you know, a wider range. But it's actually not happening. What seems to be happening is the opposite, in that in order to be part of kind of the main conversation, people feel like they need to sort of talk about the same ideas and sort of be into the same things. And it's actually kind of galvanizing the idea of celebrity. So I think that this is probably, at least for a little while, how it's going to be, that there's going to be no middle class in music.
Right.
There's just going to be 4 to 12 major personalities, just a small handful of people who are kind of in between, and then a huge mass of people who are kind of toiling in the same kind of obscurity, despite the fact that they might, you know, have 180,000 Twitter followers or something. It's like that they kind of have the illusion of success, but the real success is not there.
Right. You know, just to get back to rock music, you know, it's interesting doing this podcast, the conversations I have with people about just what rock is supposed to mean. And in my experience, what I've found is that nobody knows how to define rock music, but people know how not to define it. Like, it's hard for them to pinpoint what exactly rock means as a genre, but if you describe something as rock that they don't agree with, then they are very quick to point that out. You know, earlier you made a reference to In Rainbows being like the last major rock record. You know, I did a podcast on the last Radiohead record, and I had people on Twitter telling me that, like, Radiohead isn't a rock band, you know? Or I've had people say, you know, Car Seat Headrest, you know, they're not a rock band, they're an indie band. Or, you know, like, I had Deftones on, and they're like, well, that's a metal band, not a rock band. And in a way, I feel like this conversation about the relevancy of rock is shaped by this sort of lack of understanding about what it even is that we're talking about. I mean, I feel like when people talk about rock, that in a way they're picturing a band that is sort of like a cross between the Strokes and Guns N' Roses. You know, like 4 to 5 guys in leather jackets or who have tattoos and are decadent in some sort of way and play like riff-based songs, you know, and have, you know, they play guitars, but it's almost about more what they signify in terms of like a lifestyle is what they think about with rock. Whereas I tend to take a more sort of ecumenical view of it. Like I tend to be broad and include as much sort of that kind of guitar-based music as I can, because I think it's a very wide tree. But like, what are your thoughts on that? Like, just in terms of how that word is defined. I mean, in a way, does rock feel diminished because it's sort of like a vague term now that doesn't seem to have a definite like quality to it?
Yeah, it was an interesting thing. Okay, on the one hand, you have someone you say who tells you Car Seat Headrest is not a rock band, they're an indie band.
Right.
Well, that seems kind of preposterous because indie comes from the phrase indie rock.
Right.
Like that's a, you know, independent rock or whatever. And saying the Deftones are metal but not rock, Well, metal is a form of rock music. I mean, it's an odd thing. I mean, certainly when I was in eighth grade, I liked metal and I didn't like rock. But now I understand that that was like an eighth grade way of thinking about things. However, at the same time, the thing that you're kind of describing is kind of why I argue that rock is essentially dead or receding from the culture. Here's a good example. I heard a little bit of your conversation with Craig Finn, okay? And at one point, Craig was saying how when he was in Lifter Puller, he was like, we didn't really like to hang out with the indie people because, like, we were more rock. We were, like, more rock people. And right. What he meant by that is, like, they liked to do drugs, and they were into girls, and they liked to party, and they didn't want to go to a party where it was guys sitting around, you know, talking about records, necessarily. You know, they wanted to go to a party where they were playing records and goofing on. So that is what rock means now, in a sense. I mean, it is an umbrella term for all kinds of music, but if I said to you, I've been hanging out with a lot of rock people, you wouldn't be like, well, you must be playing a lot of Thin Lizzy records. Like, you would think that I was describing the lifestyle that went with it.
Right.
And that kind of is gone. Like, I don't know much about the car seat headrest kid. I know he's young. And he doesn't seem like he's a very rock person to me, from the little bit I've seen of him and know of him. But I feel like he's playing a form of rock music.
Right. I think it definitely is about a lifestyle and the idea that lifestyle is meaningful in some way. I think that now when people talk about that lifestyle, it is like a caricature, you know, that, you know, the idea that you're going to be like Jim Morrison in the 60s and you're going to do a lot of drugs and drink a lot because you're doing it like, you know, the Huxley, you know, you're going to like walk through the doors of perception and achieve like a higher plane of existence through decadence. You know, that sort of rock idea is like a joke now. Whereas like that was taken seriously for a long time, but it's been kind of discredited, you know.
Well, and time is moving on. I mean, the thing you're describing happened 50 some years ago, 60 years ago now.
Yeah.
It's not that different than being like saying like I'm a rocker. It's kind of like being like I'm a flapper. I'm sort of like I'm dressing like people in the 20s. I'm dancing the jitterbug and all these things, you know. That always was the case, sort of, with punk as a term.
Right.
That the idea of what it meant to be a punk, or, you know, sometimes people even use the phrase punker, which is kind of means you don't like punk music or whatever, I think, or don't. But, like, if someone said they were into punk, even as it was happening, like, you were like the episode of Quincy or whatever. I mean, that was like a, you know. And then it among people who kind of lived for music or whatever, punk had a very positive thing. It meant the most positive thing, to the point where we went through that period where it's like many people tried to go back and find rock artists and describe them as punk because they wanted to have them be part of the punk world. Like,
right.
You know, the Who are the punk band, the first punk band or whatever. Or like, you know, or the Velvet Underground were the original punk band or whatever. It's like those, it's not really true in any sense. I mean, you can't say somebody was part of a genre that didn't exist. But I understand the desire.
You know, recently on this podcast, we've been talking about how certain bands over time change in significance. How, you know, there were bands in the 90s like Blink-182 or even like Third Eye Blind that were at the time considered to be sort of flash in the pan or even like, you know, kind of ridiculous, you know, like one-dimensional bands that now are looked at least by a certain generation as being these like kind of pivotal groups. And, you know, part of that, of course, is age when these people discovered those artists. Some of it is also because those artists still have songs that are played on, like, alt-rock radio, so, you know, they've been exposed to them throughout time. And, I mean, I think it just speaks to how the artists that get played on the radio, like on classic rock radio, have in some ways been, that shapes how we look at music history. You know, the fact that, like, you know, you hear you know, Eagles songs all the time on the radio and not like Grand Parsons, you know, that has sort of shaped how people view country rock in the 70s. I'm curious, you know, another big shaper of music history in terms of rock music is the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And presumably the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame will be around, you know, for decades to come. Do you see institutions like that having any kind of influence on how these things are remembered? I mean, because there's obviously a lot of controversy about artists that get in versus artists that don't. Do you think that that will shape the narrative of rock music in a way that, you know, that because the artists that are in the Hall of Fame, that they will be considered important and artists that aren't won't be considered important?
Well, I don't know about that. I will say I am very surprised to kind of concede that the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame seems to be more important now than it was 15 years. Like, I'm surprised that its influence seems to be growing, because it does have the ability to do this one thing, which is that when a band gets into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they're back in the news cycle for a period of time. I mean, like a band like Rush, that definitely helped. It definitely helped Rush's perception to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, because I think that there was a lot of people who remembered Rush and maybe liked Rush, but had sort of been working under the opinion that Rush was lame and that they weren't that great and that it was a weird thing to be into. But, oh, I guess they're being inducted into the Hall of Fame, so I can sort of re-remember what I thought about Rush or whatever. So that does happen to a degree. But, of course, that only lasts about a year, and then it just sort of disappears. It increases the likelihood, I guess, that when, say, Geddy Lee dies, his obit will mention that his band is inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame or whatever.
But, like, what about, like, in 50 years or something, and someone goes to Cleveland and they visit the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and they're walking through the museum, and this is what they see? Like, do you think, like, that just as, like, a sort of a designated vault of rock history? Do you see something like that as having greater resonance, as we get into years where, you know, all these people will be dead and people will have no sort of firsthand knowledge of rock music? Do you think an institution like that has any sort of historical value, or do you think that they will shape the narrative for the genre?
I mean, okay, it's like, does the Smithsonian shape the narrative of history? Like, if you go into right. The Smithsonian and you see the Wright Brothers plane, like, the first thing you think is, like, boy, that looks just like the Wright Brothers plane. And you're like, oh, actually, that is the plane. That's a bizarre thing. I can't believe I'm seeing this thing. And maybe you think to yourself, maybe I need to, you know, maybe be a little more humble by how it wasn't that long ago we couldn't fly at all and these guys flew that or whatever. But I don't think then it really changes your understanding or your respect for history or whatever. I mean, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 50 years is an interesting thing to think about, since pretty much everyone in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame right now will be dead in 50
yeah.
years. I mean, I'm trying to think of Who could potentially still be alive? Is Green Day in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
Yeah.
Green Day is like my age, right? They're like 44.
Yeah.
So they would be 94. I don't know, possible, I guess. Maybe if they... with science, it's possible. We might live into our 90s, but... the narrative of rock music in 50 years, I think, will be much closer to the narrative I describe in my book.
Right.
You know, so I don't think that the idea of people, it's not like people will be like, well, how do I feel about rock music? I better go to Cleveland to sort this out, you know?
I mean, where do you see critics fitting in this? I mean, we were talking a little bit about music writing now, and you talk about this in this chapter, too, about the role that critics have played traditionally, which is critics tend to focus on music that's less popular. And because critics are the ones who write history, those sort of less popular artists have traditionally taken on an outsized importance in the music history books. And the analogy that you make, or the example that you use, is the punk versus disco distinction, mm-hmm. that for a long time, punk was always sort of held up above disco, even though disco sold exponentially more records and had a much bigger impact on mainstream culture. In recent years, we've seen a shift in that, I think. I mean, and you note this in your chapter about how now disco seems to be the more critically favored music more than punk, and that's sort of...
Because it's seen as more subversive than punk now,
right,
which
right.
is just an interesting thing, but the argument's not terrible. I mean,
right.
the argument for that, it's not like it's... It's insane that people think that. It's just real surprising. It would have been an impossible thing to anticipate 20 years ago.
But, you know, we're at a point now, and again, this may change in the future, but it seems like, you know, critics matter, you know, less and less all the time. And it seems like it's more about sort of a hive mind mentality that exists on the internet. Like, that seems to be sort of where the consensus is created. And now, you know, writers aren't really setting the pace. They're more like chasing it, it seems like. I mean, do you feel like...
I guess I would disagree with that, actually.
I think
they're slightly more important now. Just slightly. Because when you look at the 1980s, MTV dominated music taste. And the biggest bands on MTV, for the most part, were not critically appreciated. Now, because outside of, you know, the, like we said, the five or six biggest artists, because no one is that popular, a few critics getting behind a band can make sort of a significant difference for them. You know, they can, you know, it can raise their profile enough that they can tour endlessly, which you have to do now, and go into cities where they're not on the radio at all or anything and still play to 400 people or whatever and make a living. But, I mean, that's still a negligible thing. I mean, to me, the main thing that critics can do is that they can reintroduce music from the past and have it have an impact. That if a critic is writing about something that's going on right now, the average person is like, ah, they're saying this about future, or they're saying this about, you know, about Tame Impala or whatever, and I'll be like, I'll be the judge of that. I know what it sounds like. But if they bring up some artist from 1974, the person's never heard of, and tells them this is really important, that will make people go back and check it out. I mean, I think that's the main role criticism really has now, is sort of the reintroduction of people into the culture.
Right. I wanted to ask you about something that I don't think you talk about in this chapter, and that is the existence of video and audio documentation, you know, for music from the last 50 to 60, 70 years. You know, like, we don't have video of Beethoven composing. You know, we don't have audio of the first time that the Ninth Symphony was performed, but we do have video of the Beatles and Ed Sullivan. We have video of Jimi Hendrix at Monterey. We have, you know, Nirvana, you know, performing on Saturday Night Live for the first time. And when I hear music now, I mean, I think it's clear the influence that all of this sort of library of music that we have is, you know, that clearly influences artists now. You know, the fact that you can, you know, recreate sounds from previous eras so completely, I think, is a testament to, like, how the influence of that. I also think it's an influence on listeners, you know, like in the 60s, for instance, when you heard the Rolling Stones for the first time, the average listener in 1965 probably didn't have access to Robert Johnson records or Muddy Waters records. So, like, when they heard the Stones, it seemed new, it seemed fresh, and it seemed distinctly its own. Whereas now, any new music that comes out, it's so easy to deconstruct it. It's so easy to, like, track down the influences and hear how something new is similar to something old. So in a way, everything seems derivative now, even though it's kind of always been like that. We just didn't have the tools to investigate it. You know, moving forward, you know, knowing that future generations are going to be able to experience culture in a very similar way to the way that we're experiencing it, you know, because they can see the video, they can hear the music, you know, perform the way that we heard it. Do you see that having any influence on how these things are remembered and how they endure? Like, isn't it possible that in a way Jimi Hendrix will still seem fresh to people because he can be recreated so vividly in a way that, you know, music hasn't been able to be recreated in the past?
Well, that's a good point, probably. You know, I mean, visual stimulation is more, like, has a larger impact than just audio presentation. I mean, it's You remember, you know, it is easier to remember a scene from a movie in an abstract way than the lyrics of a song you've only heard in an abstract way. It's just the way things work. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I'm really answering this question. You said something earlier about, like this rediscovery of Blink 182, for example. Yeah. I think you were talking with Rob Sheffield about this because I had a similar conversation where he has these younger friends who were talking about sort of how they're arguing over what is the second best Blink 182 record, sort of as almost like having a canonical conversation about it. And, of course, we're talking about this, and even the way I'm saying this is like, isn't it crazy? But, you know, I experienced this firsthand. I mean, when I wrote Fargo Rock City, and the book opens talking about sort of the importance of Shout at the Devil, I'm sure that was the reaction of 44-year-old rock writers at the time, the thing that the reaction we're having to this Blink 182 thing. That it almost seems impossible that someone could hear that music and say, not only is this important, but its importance is almost a product of its greatness. And yet, because of MTV, Motley Crue and bands like Blink 182, and the bands that were seen as disposable, were still extremely familiar to people who never owned those records. And I don't know if that was the case for what was seen as unimportant music of the 60s and 70s.
Right.
I mean, there are people who, like, never owned a Motley Crue record who could probably, I mean, certainly now, but even when that book came out in, like, 2001, could have named three members of the band. You know, who, like, had no interest in it because they'd seen them on MTV and they had seen them in sort of these other things. So this idea that because we have this video record, I suppose these things will be more memorable.
I mean, I think the example from the 60s would be the Monkees, because like when I was a little kid in the 80s, you could watch Monkees, you know, the reruns of the Monkees show on Nick at Night. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like that band had sort of a revisionist resurgence at that time.
Because they had a TV show. That is interesting to imagine the Monkees without a TV show.
Yeah, because they were, you know, and also I think because they had really catchy songs that stood the test of time. And I mean, I think that, you know, we always have these sort of authenticity arguments for artists, you know, that mean a lot in the short term. And then as you get farther and farther away, what matters is if you have catchy songs that people enjoy, you know. And I think that's why Blink 182 has endured, because they wrote catchy songs. So like the idea that they're not really a punk band, you know, that was the argument in the 90s, that they were sort of like a, you know, like a pretty boy, like boy band, punk band type group. That doesn't matter 20 years later, because those arguments just sort of fade in the background. And it's like, in a way, once you take a band out of their sort of cultural moment, you know, those sort of larger debates that go beyond the music, they cease to matter. And it's just more about, you know, do the songs hold up or not?
Yeah, I guess I don't disagree with that. I mean, like, the authenticity problem, I mean, it's like something we're not even supposed to think about anymore, which I just blows my mind. I just think it's the most hilarious thing that it'd be like that someone could be against the idea of authenticity in art. I have suspicions why someone might think that, but you're right though, in that when an artist is alive, the realness of what they do seems to matter more than how real it was in retrospect. I mean, you know, I think I maybe even used this example when I was on your podcast before or something. I mean, the idea that, like, Paul McCartney and John Lennon would, like, sit down and say, like, let's write a swimming pool today. Like, let's write a song that would allow us to build swimming pools in our house. We hear that now. It's like, that's kind of a charming thing. It almost makes them seem extra talented or whatever. They could just do that. But you would not want to hear a present-day artist saying that. Although, maybe that's something that you would say in hip-hop now. It's like, it just seems odd to me that when somebody is living, that you sort of want them to be as authentic as possible, but when you just sort of remember them retroactively, it's almost like you want to prove that the art was fake.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the impact of Napster. I think Napster, you know, and sort of the, you know, music being free, I think it, like, in a way, it cleared the decks for that argument, because now people feel like, well, if you're going to do a commercial, like, good for you, because at least you're getting some sort of money for what you're doing. I mean, I think now, and I've said this before, I mean, I think celebrity is the new authenticity. I think that, like, if you are famous, then, and you have, like, a certain following, and you can prove how, like, you know, like how big of a cultural footprint you have, then that is what makes your art authentic.
Did you happen to read Moby's memoir?
No.
Okay, well, first of all, I'm not a big Moby fan, but I'm not against him, but this memoir is very good. It's extremely interesting, and it's about his life up until the release of the Play record. So the whole book is basically when he was completely anonymous or a superstar DJ, which is in the mainstream kind of a, you know, anonymous to a degree, and he talks about, like, animal rights and stuff. But at the very end of the book, he's talking about the original idea for Play, and, you know, that record, famously, every song was licensed to a movie or a commercial or something before the record even came out. Looking back now, that seems like a pretty important moment in music, because he was criticized for doing that, but no one cared about the criticism who liked the music.
Right.
Like, there were people who, I think there was even maybe like a New York Times Magazine story about Moby at the time, and sort of compared what he was doing to, like, the music you hear in a soccer mom's van. For some reason, I really remember that phrase being somewhere. And that was the kind of thing that a music writer would still have said. But the consumer did not. The consumer did not care at all. It just made no difference to them. In fact, Play was really successful because I think that when people bought it, they liked the fact that they'd be like, oh, yeah, I heard this, or, hey, isn't that in that Mazda commercial? It kind of helped.
Right.
And we're now at a point where, like, no music writer would even make that accusation.
Right.
Like, you know, it's – and I feel like another moment in that was when, like, Bob Dylan was in a Victoria's Secret ad.
Right.
Because it's like he's appearing on Dharma and Greg or whatever. It's like, if he's going to do these things, and he's the ultimate example that we use of this, well, you know, who's still fighting that battle?
Right. Yeah, we're running out of time here, so I just want to circle back quickly to your book, and because we haven't actually talked about who you decided was the one person in rock that will end up being the signifier of the genre. And can I say who this is? I mean, like, would I be spoiling it, or should we keep
it? I don't think so. I mean, if somebody listened to this whole podcast, I have a feeling they bought the book.
Okay, so the person you settle on is Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
And you go through a bunch of justifications for that, talking about, you know, musically, you know, making simple direct rhythm-based music, talking about sort of his relationship to as an African-American kind of blues-based guy, you know, how he was essentially, I guess you could say, he either influenced white rock bands, or he was ripped off by them, however you want to phrase that. Him being lawless, you know, the fact that he went to prison a couple of times. Was that a process to get to Chuck Berry? I mean, was that someone you figured going into the chapter who was going to be, or did you kind of go through some other people in your mind before you settled on him?
Well, okay, the premise for that section is this. Okay, to me, in a rational, logical, predictable world, the answer to this question, if there's one artist who will be remembered from all of rock music and will come to represent the entire genre, you know, by themselves, should be the Beatles. Like, that's the reasonable answer. But the world's not a reasonable place, okay? And there's also a couple problems with the Beatles. Well, three problems, specifically. One is that they're a group, not a person, and it tends to be easier for society to remember an individual as opposed to a collective, although you could say that the Beatles altered that by making a group seem like a person. But nonetheless, they're a group, okay? They're not American, and rock music is fundamentally an American art. And they're white, and rock music is fundamentally based in black music. So there are some problems with this, that if the idea of rock music is going to remain, they contradict that idea in a few ways. So if it's not the Beatles, even though musically and by merit it should be them, if it's going to be other things, who is it going to be? And then I just kind of worked through the process. I started thinking about why anything is remembered. And the reason things tend to be remembered very often is not for the accomplishments of any one person, but sort of the tropes of the entity kind of on a broad canvas. The things about rock music that we were talking about earlier, you know, when someone says they're into rock, has these meanings, right, that aren't related to music, or they're vaguely related to music. What are those tropes? What are those themes? And when you start lining them up, it seems to be describing Chuck Berry. He seems to be the purest distillation of what rock music is in an abstract sense. So that's sort of how I came to that conclusion. And I don't even know if, I mean, I obviously can't see the future. I kind of throw in all the sort of ancillary possibilities. I mean, the idea that rock music could be remembered through a song or through the existence of a really sort of insignificant band that were something that we consider insignificant, that seems highly possible, maybe more so in rock music than in other forms of art. But I just think that if it's not the Beatles, it will probably be Chuck Berry.
Yeah, I mean, and I love this answer, by the way. I mean, I love Chuck Berry. Have you seen that documentary, Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, it's one of the great documentaries about...
If I remember, there's a great line in it where, like, Bruce Springsteen saying something like, I've never seen a chocolate Cadillac, but I know exactly what it looks like. He has a real good line in it.
So I love this answer, but I don't think I agree with it. And my counter would be that if you're going to write a history of like the 20th century, and just not music history, but just history, like if there's a history course on 20th century life, it's hard for me to imagine that you could have that class or write that book and not talk about Elvis Presley and Bob Dylan. I feel like not only are they hugely musically important, I just feel like the tentacles of their influence extends into so many different areas in culture of that time that it would be impossible for them not to remain historically significant in my mind. So to me, I would pick one of those two as the... I would probably settle on Bob Dylan because I feel like Bob Dylan is the center of music history that you can draw a line to him from so many different corners and so many different, different bands, different subgenres of rock. I feel like the most lines go to him more than anyone else. So that would be my argument for Dylan.
No, I mean, that's a good argument. And Elvis and Dylan are the two towering individuals in rock music. But there's just, I just think interesting problems with both of them. Elvis, the fact that he didn't write his music and was more of a celebrity in many ways and just an interpreter of songs, while that doesn't in any way negate his importance, if somebody is interested in what rock was, that would be a skewed perception of how rock worked. And Dylan, I just kind of directly say this, like the biggest problem is his songs don't rock. I mean, if somebody said to you, like...
Highway 61 Revisited?
Yeah, that's as close as it comes. And like Hard Rain and stuff, if someone said to you, like, make me a mix CD of the most rockin' Bob Dylan songs, and you got to pick 12 of them, how rockin' is that going to be?
See, this could...
I mean, I'm not saying that this is some sort of artistic criticism.
Right.
Dylan sucks, he doesn't rock enough. But like, his songs don't rock. I mean, he's more like, electrified folk music or whatever. So there again, it would be like the person who represents this idea that we were talking about, that like Craig Finn can describe in a word and we all know what he means. Is Bob Dylan really the person who represents that? I don't know. I just I think in some ways Jimi Hendrix is a good candidate for this, although what he did was so unique and so sort of unlike even his closest peers but at the same time, I probably, if I had to go back and rewrite that chapter, I might have put a little more emphasis on the possibility that it will be Hendrix.
Yeah, I mean, if you could have had like 10 more years, I think it'd be a different conversation. What's tough with him is that it's just such a small body of work.
Although I think in this case, over the long haul, it helps.
Yeah, that's true.
He has these three records, and that he died early, which is also going to be probably a signifier of what rock was. Guys dying in from drugs and plane crashes. I mean, that's like part of it. I don't know if there were, in 200 years, like, would people be like, well, he only made three records, he should have made six. If he had made a record with Miles Davis, I think that would have been something, because that would have maybe, that would have been another sort of narrative-altering thing within the relationship between rock and jazz.
Yeah.
It's stronger than it currently does. I mean, now the relationship between rock and jazz is like Steely Dan, and that's as close as it gets.
Right, right. Well, Chuck, I've kept you as long as I can. I know you got to get going, so thank you so much.
No problem, man.
It's always a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Okay.
All right, that was Chuck Klosterman. His latest book, again, is called But What If We're Wrong? Again, that was his third time on the podcast. Always a great guest. That was a lot of fun. Guys, if you are a fan of this podcast, it would be great if you helped us spread the word. If you can go on iTunes and leave a review or even just a rating, that's enormously helpful for us. If you can talk about us on social media, you know, and say that this is a good place to talk about music, that would be phenomenal as well. Even if you just email a friend or text a friend and say that this is a fun podcast and you should check it out. All of these things are enormously helpful, and they help us grow our audience. So if you can help us with that, I would really appreciate it. Also, I want to mention, I haven't mentioned this for a couple of weeks because I didn't want to inundate you guys with marketing, but my latest book, my first book, called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, it came out in May, and you can still buy it. It's still in stores. You can still get it. And I would really appreciate it. It's sort of like this podcast, of course, but you're reading my words instead of hearing me. So I think you will enjoy it if you enjoy this podcast. Otherwise, guys, thank you so much for listening. Again, this was a lot of fun, and we look forward to doing it again next week.